to get hold of the idea of an internal condition governing your external circumstances, and the idea of the planets having effects on external circumstances as internal to the universe, how the one was working inside the other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't quite get it very clear.
So. I suppose when we start off by drawing a large circle to represent the whole universe, this is Anton's proof of the existence of God. Imagine a circle in which you can imagine no larger, and that circle is God. Outside that is a Godhead, but that particular circle is God. If you can imagine a larger one than this, well then the first one isn't God, but the other one is. Now, we know today, not theoretically but practically, that matter is force behaving in a certain way. So the conservation of matter and energy of the early 19th century has given way to the conservation of mass energy, not matter. Matter is matura. I remember the M implies a closure. Matura is a rotation of primary power. So this must be conceived as a dynamic in swing of power, and everything inside it is going round. Now you can see a very peculiar thing about this, because although there is only one circle and the one power, if we put a rod on it to measure it, we immediately find that there are different speeds in the one being. Supposing we imagine that this is a cardboard circle, and we put a peg in the middle of it and spin it, so that the whole circle of cardboard is one, and therefore it cannot be moving at different velocities, because there's only one, and the parts of it are not changing place relative to each other. But if we put a rod across it and measure it by marking on the disc a particular marker, and when it goes round we call it a half circle when it gets to there, and when it comes back again to here we call it a full circle, we see a very peculiar thing, because relative to this rod, the size of this perimeter is greater than another one inside, and another, and so on. So if we mark this in terms of units, we'll take 12 to begin with. We could call those like the hours on a clock. If we imagine this is a clock face made in cardboard, and instead of the fingers rotating, we arrange a drive whereby the clock face rotates, we will see, if we measure the distance across there, we'll say, for instance, in this case, we'll pretend it's 2 inches here. Well, if we draw that to the centre, that one must be less than 2 inches. We'll say that it's 3/4, and there it's a half, and so on here, quarter. Now, we can see that as the whole thing is fixed and is one, if it turns, then relative to this rod, the distance traversed by the perimeter is greater there than this distance, greater than that, and so on. So it appears then that the nearer we go to the centre, the slower it is going, although it is really only one, and therefore relative to itself and its internal relations, the whole thing is moving at the same speed. Yet relative to an external marker, like this imaginary rod, then there are different speeds. So we could say that the perimeter of the universe is travelling at a very, very great speed, but the centre of it is not travelling at all. Now if we imagine that that is the Earth, now here's the equator, there's the pole, and there's another one below, the speed of the Earth's rotation at the equator is about 18 miles per second. And at the poles, it's nil, although the Earth is one. so that if we put a marker outside, an imaginary marker like the moon, and imagine for a moment we can fix it, then if we mark on here, say, Honolulu or something, and let it spin round, marked against the moon, it will be doing 18 miles per second, and at the pole, nil. So if we go along the different latitudes there, we will find different apparent speeds. And this is one of the causes of the difference of metabolism, the chemistry in the blood, in different peoples. Equatorial peoples run a faster rate of metabolism than polar peoples. And that diagram of the Earth is exactly the same as the diagram for the universal sphere. Now, remember that matter is only force behaving in a certain way, namely rotating. Because we have represented this universe as a rotation, we say that when we are considering force rotating, we are talking about the material universe. But that material universe is simply the universe as rotating. Outside here, we call it not material because it doesn't rotate. And in the process of rotating, we get this relative decrease as we go towards the center. So that for ourselves as Earth beings, it appears to us that the Earth is still, because we are moving with it at the same velocity that it moves at whatever latitude we live at. So if we consider the whole universal sphere as a rotation of power, we can see that there are different velocities inside here, so that it's very important at what point within the universe you are born, because all the velocities or forces in the universe are relative to your relation to the perimeter and the center. So we could say the nearer to the center you are, the more still you are, and the nearer to the perimeter, the more in motion you are. We can describe the same diagram and let it represent, if you like, one living organism, a single cell, an egg, an amoeba without any pseudopodia sticking out. We can see that the perimeter of it must be apparently moving more quickly than the internal. And if we remember also that it would be the point stimulated from outside, we can see that the whole of your external part, your skin surfaces, your eyes, your ears, nose, etc., your five sense organs, are the ones that are going to be disturbed from outside. And that the more you can internalize your attention, the more you are able to control yourself. Control, incidentally, means count the roles, and the roles referred to are the roles of your substantial form, which is the same thing as your memory, the roles of the memory. Remember, if a force goes in your organism and goes out again without rotating, it is no memory, it is an immediate reaction. But if it goes in and rotates, it makes a memory for the duration of the rotation. That's one of the roles you've got to count. And inside you may have a lot of roles like this. And altogether they constitute your memory. We'll come back to those later on, because from this diagram we can prove that what you think is yourself is merely formal, and the egoic center, the ahankara of the yogis, is purely mechanical and can do nothing whatever except react to stimuli. So we'll come back to that diagram later. Meanwhile, we have to remind ourselves of this sphere, which as rotating is called matter, is really a force system. And therefore, it is tremendously important at what point you come to be. Supposing we remember that every being is a rotation, that soul itself is solo, it is force made solo. The U in soul simply means power, drive. So S-O-L, soul, the name of the sun, because there's only one of it in this system, and in any other system there is one. Solo means one, the sun, soul, and solo with power is soul. A cell is so called because it contains, within a rotation, a certain amount of work, formal work. A self implies there is consciousness in it. The F at the end of self means spirit, and spirit is consciousness. So supposing we imagine this is the big universal circle, and inside it we have the star system, which we'll mark off with stars. And those stars are, if you like, the outermost band of formal influences. And they are radiating all the time. And if you look at them, you find that they're all spinning structures. You see in the case of the spiral nebulae that there is evidence photographically that they are centres of vortical activity, spin centres. So if we have two stars, one there and one there, and they're both spinning into centres like this, they must be exhausting the space between. If we say there's the star band, we'll write the word star and see what it means. Because star is a spirit, ta-rota. So a star is a rotation of force. And if we come inside here, we find another one, a subsidiary one, the solar system. We'll mark that as a little star. And going around that, the planetary system, of which one is the Earth. Now we have a series of movements here. From the perimeter there to the centre, we have a gradation, the degrees of movement. We are in one system, and therefore we are already conditioned. Before we are born, we are conditioned as forms within our ancestors. In the Bible, you notice it said in one place, how did you know him? I knew him when he was in Abraham's loins. Which is a statement that the seed in a man is a vortical spin center, and that intelligence is screwing itself in and compacting itself to make one of those bearers of form, bearers of hereditament, because hereditament is only a form of power. So, providing we conceive this universe as one whole wheel of power, and we see the relative velocities according to the distance from the perimeter to the centre, we can understand why it is that only at certain points in the universe is it possible to learn to balance. There are places in the universe where no type of balance can be gained because the velocity is too great. There are others where it cannot be gained because everything is too passive, it can't move towards it. And only in between the two extremes is it possible to make such a balance of forces that a free being may come to exist. Now if we take the word Earth, remember that hear, O Israel, is the first commandment. There's the ear. The ear has in it a little sounding board. And in exactly the same way, the Earth is a sounding board for various forces which are echoing backwards and forwards from the centre to the perimeter and back again, and they're swinging over in figures of eight all the way around. And at the intersection points of those is this solar system with the Earth travelling round it. Now, you know, once upon a time it was taught that the Earth was the centre of the universe, and afterwards it was said that this wasn't true because the Earth is moving. And you know that Einstein's demonstrations that motion is relative have made it possible to see what might have been meant by the ancients when they said that the Earth was the centre of the universe. If you take the H off the end of Earth and put it at the other end, it makes a heart, which is the centre of the thing. If you leave the other H, it makes hearth, which is the centre of the home. And the hirath is the power law. And this is the power law which we are concerned with, this sphere as force rotating. The Earth actually has, within the solar system, the central orbit, not in terms of distance from the Sun to the outer band of Pluto, but in terms of the mass of the solar system and the resonances that are cutting across it from the Sun to the outer limit of the solar system and back again. And at that intersection point, that nodal point of that eight wave, if you like, there's an orbit. round which the sun is travelling and the earth is travelling round it in this manner. And thus, upon the earth, there is a possibility of beings having the right kind of speed of presentation of form. That is to say, the thinking process can be controlled, and it is therefore an educational centre within the universe itself. And providing we remember that we're dealing with forces, we can easily understand how there are these relative differences from the perimeter to the centre of the whole being. Remember, when we're talking about being, we're talking about circumscription. There is no being other than rotation of force. If the force stops rotating, it is no longer called being, because this letter B, the beta, means a house, a dwelling, a circumscribed zone. While we're on this subject, we can consider very carefully a very important fact. The fact that at the lowest level of consciousness for a human being, ideas and feelings are apparently distinct. That is, you can think without feeling. You can say 2 and 2 is 4. And while you are doing so, you don't particularly feel emotionally disturbed about it. But at the top level, if you say 2 and 2 are 4, then you are also feeling something about it, necessarily. And we will now see why. We said that the word idea was a Greek word for the Latin form, the Saxon shape. And you can see, if you look at it, id, which became the Latin it, air, which is the same air in earth, and it means spiritual activity dividing. So the idea of spirit as dividing itself, which involves a half rotation, the D, and there's the other half, that's 2 D's back to back. Idea is that which we can use to analyze the absolute. We analyze it, that is to say, we loose the motions in it in order to consider them. And every idea is a motion of force. So that if we can define means set the limits of the application of a word, we have defined a type of motion, a velocity, and a direction. If we take a definite amount of force plus a direction, we call it a vector. And if we conceive the universe in terms of vectors, we are considering it as forces moving in definite directions, in which case we could conceive the whole universe as a vector system. So an idea is necessarily circumscribed, and any circumscription whatever is legitimately called an idea. Now, in philosophy, it is very important to understand that if we're dealing with Platonic philosophy, when Plato uses this word, idea, he means a form in the universal. He would deny that it was a legitimate use of the word idea to say that you have an idea of a particular thing you have seen with your senses, with your eye, or with your ear, and so on. You cannot have an idea, he says, except of universal form. And he's talking about this fact that all ideas are circumscriptions, and there is one big circumscription, which is the Logos, which word was borrowed by the early Christians from Platonic sources. The Stoics called the universe itself Logos as well. Plato uses the same idea and calls it the demiurge, the half-worker, because outside it is that which does not rotate. So if this is called God by some people, it is by those people who prefer to be free. And if this is called God, and only this, within the circle, it is called God by those people who want security. But if those beings exist who don't care whether they are secure or insecure, they can use the word God, if they wish, for both or neither. They can say God is whatever we choose to will, because the object of the will is the good, and God is good. Therefore, that is your God towards which you will. Where the treasure is, there is the heart also, is a statement. That is your God to which you will. That towards which you exert your force to attain. So, if we call this a God, inside here, in Christians, we call this the Godhead, that which is before and without, outside the God. But it also goes underneath, the white paper is going underneath all this drawing, and therefore we say that the Godhead is immanent in God. And for all ordinary purposes of worship, we are concerned with the consideration of this God, simply because we live and move and have our being inside it, and are already conditioned by it, and we cannot get out of this God into that one without first of all learning how to control the motions inside it, which are inside our own being. It is possible for us, if we wish to, and we learn a certain amount of self-control, to travel from where we are outwards more and more towards the perimeter of the universe. And if we go right to the limit of it, and we have got sufficient integration, we could force our way out and become a little universe on our own, outside it. That would be called, from the point of view of the God inside, a devil had been spewed out into the outer darkness. From our own point of view, it might be that we want to experiment and make a universe outside. But if we conform and move towards this center more and more, we are then said to be worshipping this God. And we are said to be followers of this one God, and he will not spew us out of the mouth into the outer darkness. Because quite obviously, if we are moving towards the perimeter, and we are a substantial modification of the whole force of that being, then we cannot be disobeying its function. We must become more and more passive to the centre, because we said that the amount of action going on around that is relatively greater than that going on in the centre. So if we begin to become less law-breaking and more law-abiding in the universal sense, we apparently cut down the motion on the outside and move towards the centre and become obedient to that God. But there are some beings who do not like to do that. In the Bible they're called goats and devils and so on. They say we don't want to do that, we want to go the other way and eventually get thrown out and make little universes of our own. And that is a matter for individual choice. Fundamentally, you can see that if a being comes into existence here, remember existence is existere, which means out of a sixfold wheel. Simply, if something starts rotating there, that is a soul, because it is rotating. If it is born on the perimeter, it will like it, and the idea of moving that way will seem to it to be wrong, because it would seem to be denying its own activity. But if, on the other hand, it came to be near the centre, then it would appear to it to be a great degeneration to have to move away from the centre. You remember Emanuel Swedenborg had some visions in which he went to heaven, as he conceived it ought to be, and he saw Jesus Christ in the middle, and a series of concentric circles, and the farther away you went from the middle, the darker it was, and right on the perimeter here were a lot of ministers of the gospel arguing about heresies and things. And Swedenborg was allowed to go right to the inner circle, because he was a very good man. But he was very, very startled to find that when he went into the outer circles to convert these various sectarians, that they were not converted and didn't like his arguments. And you may remember that William Blake on one occasion was visited by an angel who showed him that he was worshipping what in effect was a horrible pit of filth. Whereupon William Blake, undismayed, took the angel to the angel's heaven and showed him also something very, very horrible. Whereupon the angel said, "You are imposing on me." To which Blake replied, "We are imposing on each other." Because fundamentally, good, if you see the goo, it doesn't matter how you spell it, goo is still goo. The gullet inside you is a little ghoul. Ghoul is the same as a will of appetite, prime drive. So the gullital nature in you is really the center of appetite. The actual physical tissue, with the spontaneous movements that are going on in that gullital worm, it's the old worm of the Bible, the old serpent, the movements in it are all drawing in to grab what they can, and that is the ghoul. Now, if we put D in there, that's as far as it goes. When it says in the Bible that God said, let there be so-and-so, and then he saw it was good, this is the same God. As a matter of fact, in Manx, it's the ghoul was the G, and the G was the ghoul. It's the same way they say that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Ghoul and G are the same fellow. This ghoul is the primary go. You've got what you call get up and go. Prime drive. And it goes as far as it wishes to, and then stops. And then it utters, I have gone far enough, or good. If you really make, you can pronounce it properly and say good. So, the good resides in the belly zone. We'll put G for good down there, and it's G for gamma, or gammon, whichever you prefer. Good there, beauty there, and truth in your head. The good, the beautiful, and the true. We put the true in the head because it relates to form. The good in the belly because it relates to how far your gullible appetite goes. And between the two, in the conflict, in the opposition of form, which is truth, and urge, or prime drive, which is restrained by form, between the two, as form presses down and will or gullet presses up, there arises a resolution of form and will, which when perfectly balanced we call beautiful. Notice in the word beauty, I think we did this one before, we might as well write it in French, it will save a letter on you. There is water in French, it's a French derived word. In the middle is the O, the water. And beauty is this uninterrupted motion. The sensation you get when you see a well-composed painting or listen to a well-composed piece of music is that somehow this is inevitable, that is a flow. And this is the O in the beauté. So beauty implies the sensation arising from the uninterrupted fulfillment of your will. Now, we revert to this idea, concept, it is a rotation. And we say that the whole universe is a big idea, the Logos. But inside it, there are other rotations like this, which determine the orbits of stars, the orbits of the solar system, the orbits of planets, screwing themselves round. You can see the whole thing, literally, is full of tiny rotations. And if we drill these rotations right down to the tiniest one we can, that is an ultimate particle which science will try to discover. When it's getting near to the electron, it's getting near to it, but the electron is not it. It's considerably finer, more subtle than that. So, we have a system here of rotations, and idea implies this rotation, and as far as a rotation goes, that is an idea. But a rotation is an actual motion of force, which is fundamentally spirit, self-mobilized, which at the point of initiation we call will, and therefore we could say that the universe is a function of will. If we say a function of divine will, divine is this div root, which is the dio in the Latin, it's div in Sanskrit, it's the dio in Jupiter, God the Father. And read this way, videre, to see. God is he who sees what he is doing. If a man knows what he's doing, can see what he's doing, execute his purposes, we say he is divine, and we talk about the divine. This ein, incidentally, is a form of the word one. In German, they've anagrammed it a little, turn it round, E-I-N, ein. In the Hebrew, we would spell it in English with an A-Y-I-N, ayin. And in Egyptian, it is quite simply a drawing of a human eye. So the idea of unity is the same thing as the idea of a self, an ego. So if you get unity, then you are becoming one person. But if you do not get unity, then you are not one person, but many. You're a schizophrenic. Christ said, the eye of the body is the light of the body. If thine eye be single, then the whole being is full of light. So that the unity
of your body depends on the unity of the eye, the observer, the watcher, and that watcher is fundamentally a force which at the point of initiation is called will, and therefore unity of will is the only way of getting light, which is understanding, which is wisdom, as a dome, a whizzing dome. An idea, therefore, is any rotation whatever, and we see that all these rotations are travelling all the time, and therefore we can see that any idea can pass into any other idea. Therefore translation is possible from one language to another, and synonyms exist, and so on. And antonyms are related very, very intimately, because when an idea is round there and has travelled round to there, it is that same one which has become its opposite on the other side. Because opposite means at the two ends of a diameter through the ob. So an idea then is a rotation of a force. The force is fundamentally will, and all these rotations take place in the field. Kshatriya is the Sanskrit for field. The warrior is called Kshatriya, he who affirms the struggle in the field of forces. This is a field of forces, and the rotations within the forces are centres to the field, so that whenever there is a rotation, you can call that a centre of the field. So we say that the centre of the universe is anywhere. That is, wherever there is a vortical spin, it is a centre. We then see that an idea is a very peculiar thing. It is force, intelligence, moving. It is not a static thing. Lots of very bad European commentators on Plato have suggested that his concept of the ideal world was a world of static form, and they have then wasted their time tilting at it, when he says quite definitely that an idea is an intelligent being persisting in being itself. In fact, you can't find any Greek philosopher of that period who does not believe that an idea is a piece of intelligence behaving in a certain way. If we go into Arabic mystical sources, we find spirits called jinn, and the control of the jinn, you know, the same as the jinn in the bottle in the Arabian Nights. Jinn is the word to judge. It's the din of the Hebrew, you know, the Hebrew place where they make sure that everything is kosher, is called Beit Din, the house of judgment. And this din means judge. It's the Oxford Don. The word Don is the same thing. Judge, the tribe of Dan. You can change the vowel about because the function is D-N, where D means analysis and N means continuous motion. So continuous motion analysing is the same thing as judge, the judge who goes along dividing. An idea, therefore, is an intelligent being moving along and witnessing itself. And this is why ideas are very, very hard to control, because they are not static. They are continuously developing themselves. Those ideas are having children, that is, derivative ideas. And each idea is the centre of a field of force, which, viewed from the point of view of initiation, is called a will. Therefore, any idea you have is evidence that you have also a will to that idea. So unless you get an idea big enough to comprehend other ideas, you haven't got a will big enough to comprehend all the derivative wills of your nature. And the whole problem of self-control is in the cell of your being to set up the role and count it so that you know what you've got. Until you know what you have on your rolls formally, you cannot have control. You can't count what you haven't got, and you can't count what you don't know about, even if you have got it. And it has to be realized that ideas are so intelligent, much more so than the average fellow is intelligent, because an idea knows when you are trying to control it, and it will deliberately become quiet, so that you don't know it is there. An idea within your own being can deliberately hide. It can also do another funny trick. It can persuade other ideas to obscure it. related ideas, it can send them up to consciousness and say, explain that I've given it up, I've reformed. So that your governing concept, which is your idea, nothing else, a governing concept, your idea of yourself as an improved being, which is only another idea, is deceived and duped by other ideas who say, if your governing concept to control us is allowed to succeed, we won't be able to enjoy ourselves. Therefore, in order to make quite sure that you do not get control of us, we are going to mess everything up. The other day, a little girl that was apparently enjoying going to school vomited tremendously all day long. When she was questioned, she said she liked school and so on. And she's, how old is she now? She's 8. She's been told about one or two things, and she knows that the mind has a lot hidden in it. I asked her whether she really wanted to go to school, and she said definitely she did. And she was telling the truth. I said, is there anything at school at all that you don't like? And she said, I don't like the voice of the woman in the next room who teaches. I said, does it distress you? And she said, I don't know whether it does or not, but I don't like it. So I said, well, will you think of it now, very, very carefully, and imagine that you're going to go in the same room with that woman and see what happens. And she closed her eyes and imagined it and probably vomited. So I then told her that she need not go into that room at all, and in fact, she could imagine that she wasn't going to school the next day. And I then said, do you feel sick? And she said, yes, I still feel sick. I said, hold this idea in your mind. Remember, this is a child of 8. Hold the idea in your mind that you're not going to go to school tomorrow and then try and be sick. Now, she held that idea very firmly with her eyes closed, and then she tried to be sick and she failed. And she said, why is that? So I told her, because when you formulate ideas in the mind, every idea is the center of a feeling. And these feelings are either I like it or I don't like it. And if they're I don't like it, they send messages down the nerves to the stomach, and they squeeze it and say to it, we don't like this situation. And the stomach responds by kicking out the food which would give it the energy to get into the situation it doesn't like. You see the internal logic there. That the stomach is breaking matter down to give you energy so that you can do something. So that if you don't like what it is that you've got to do, you send a message to the stomach not to break down that matter into energy, because if we get the energy, we'll have to do so and so. So there's a very intimate relationship between the activities in your stomach, the whole digestive process. Dige means break the earth up to release the energy. So that you can see what is meant really by Christ's statement, you've got to become innocent like that child. Because that child really believed and looked in its own mind, and it had no preconception. And it found in its mind that there were two things it didn't like. The first one was the lady with the harsh voice. And the other thing was, she had had to play an organized fun game with the other children, a thing she's never done in her life before. She's never had any organized anything. Organization to her meant restriction of her will. So she didn't want to play organized fun games, and she didn't like this harsh voiced lady in the next room. That's two very good reasons. So the message went down to the stomach and kicked out all the food which would have become the energy to take her into a situation she didn't want. The result was that it was decided to let her not go today so that she could observe that there was no tendency in her to become sick. So throughout the whole of today, she's just played about and had no trouble at all. And very badly said, today I'm all right. And I said, did you think about whether you liked things or didn't throughout the day? And she said, yes. And there were only the two things that I didn't like. And then she said, but today is Thursday, and then there's Friday, and then there's Saturday and Sunday, before Monday comes. And two of those days which I am not going to go to school are Saturday and Sunday, and they're not holidays, those are mine in any case. So she said, I'm really most pleased about Thursday and Friday not going. So you can see, fundamentally, the will is adding things up all the time. Now we tend to think that the intellectual side of our being is separate from the volitional side, and it is not, because the tel in intellect, in intelligence, is the Greek telos, purpose. It means simply will. driving along to a definite purpose, which means that there is no intellect other than the will to formulate. It means there is no reason other than the will to explain itself. Now, modern psychologists are not quite clear about this. They think that a man can reason independently of his volitional bias. A heresy that the Marxists are aware of when they say that a man cannot will to be truly logical, he can only will to rationalize his will's intention. And the thing, therefore, if you wish to become really logical, is to will to conform to the ruling principle of the universe, which is logical because only logic is efficient. Now, you know, there are two big groups within the Roman Church of Dominicans and Franciscans. Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican. And in order to keep control of people, you have to postulate that reason is prior to will. You have to say that the universe is inherently reasonable and that we will never get away with willful behavior because the universe is reasonable and we must be destroyed if we are unreasonable within a reasonable universe. So Aquinas, lifting out this concept partially from Aristotle, and in order to bolster up the authority of the church in matters of truth, which is the same as form, which is presented rationally, the ratio of form to form, he said, therefore, that in God reason is superior to will. And therefore every will have to become reasonable. But the Franciscans don't believe in the dom, in Dominicans. They don't like the limitation. They don't like the bondage. The Franciscans, Francis means free. So they said the will of God is prior to his intellect, because whatever there is of reason in the divine is only so because God wills to be reasonable. He isn't inherently reasonable. He is essential will, willing to be reasonable because it's more efficient. And if ever it becomes efficient to behave in another way, that would be spontaneously an expression of his will to the good. And it would always be a rationalization of his will. If, therefore, when we look inside ourselves, instead of wasting time looking for what we would call our reason for doing something, if we look for our motive, the state of our will, and ask ourselves a very simple pair of questions. Are we willing to destroy at the moment, or are we willing to build? Are we willing to be enemies with this person or friends with this person? Are we willing to set fire to the place or to throw water on it, and so on? It's a very simple opposition in the will. Either the will is willing to cooperate, to be harmonious, to build, or it is willing to oppose, to refuse to cooperate, and to destroy. And if we turn to the will, we are turning to the cause, because the concept of cause, that encounters us to strike, is no more than a force applied, and all force is fundamentally, from the point of view of initiation of action, will. Therefore, Julius Caesar is made by Shakespeare to say, the cause is in my will. So if we want to examine the causes of events, we should not examine the reasons other than the volitional reasons I am building or I am destroying. So, an idea, as we see, is a rotation, and all these rotations are travelling round, and therefore an idea is continuously changing its significance as we talk about an idea. You notice in the language we talk about ideas. If we were to talk of an idea, of is the same as the word of, we would find a totally different kind of mental process. Talking about is ab and out. It's away from. So if I wanted to talk about football, then I would say football, yes, football. It's a game. That places me immediately to consider a certain class of activities called games, and to select one of them out called a ball game. And it isn't a game of cricket or golf or something. It's football we're talking about,
and they have a bladder with a very strong case outside so that when they kick it, it doesn't burst. Then I have to explain what a bladder is. So it's a thing that you fill with air and expand it, and the case outside is made of very, very strong leather. This is ab and out football. Ultimately, it's a question of a man who has, at the end of his legs, a certain structure called a foot, one on each, and that he applies energy through his limbs to this terminal point, and applies that terminal point to this blown-up bladder or something inside a leather container, and persists in driving it beyond other fellows with the same information, and attempting to get it between two sticks, all of which is ab and out football. Analyze it internally without destroying it, which is very, very difficult and requires a tremendous amount of energy. It requires energy because every idea is a force, and when you are thinking, you are trying to dislodge, disrupt forces which are bound together in a certain way. This is why thinking is difficult, because it involves you in energy expenditure when you analyze an idea, because it is made up of subsidiary ideas, each one of which is a center of force, which fundamentally is a will. And if you don't analyze it in such a way that it is pleased, it will oppose your analysis. Now, when we're talking about this universe in terms of volition, in terms of sentiency, intelligent substance, that's the old idea of what the Greeks call the hylozoist idea, where the hyle of the Greeks is the word that we translate matter, although incorrectly. The Saxon word is much better, stuff, because stuff does not imply matura, rotation. Just implies spatial occupancy in stuff. And the zoe root is, of course, life. So hylozoism means the stuff of the universe is alive. We can then consider that as a giant, single-celled being, internal to which there are some fluids and little particles, and the fluids are always rotating, and those rotations are the forms of the activity internal to that hylozoic universe. In which case we can then call the whole thing up there a universal soul. That is the anima mundi of the philosophers of the ancient world. The world soul is a living substance which is fundamentally will when we consider it as initiating the process. And as eternal, we call it spirit form. Spirit means energy formulating itself. So, we've seen here that this idea involves analysis of a prime activity, and that the whole process of the universe illustrated here shows us how the stars being formed in a certain place must send their radiations in curves through each other all the time. Now the ancients said very, very clearly, the sun sends out light, but it doesn't diminish because it is being fed. And the idea that light from this star is radiating and going round here, and this star is receiving some of it and also radiating, and they're all radiating across to each other, is what is meant by Gurdjieff in the reciprocal feeding. He just lifted the idea out of the sources of Indian metaphysics. The Japanese word for it is the same concept, mutual interpenetration of forces, jiji muge they call it, driving in of all beings into each other. It's the same thing that Plotinus and the Neoplatonists meant by compenetration, where every force leaving its center must necessarily traverse the whole sphere and enter all others. So that in our paralogic, the logic beyond Aristotelian logic, we say that every being is itself and simultaneously every other being. Because if you remember that B means rotate, and all the rotations are going round here, whatever rotation is there, the force is leaving it and going into another place. And therefore every point of the universal field, or the universal soul, contains motions from all of them. And therefore, every single point in the universe is identical with all the others, essentially.
And therefore the only difference between centres within the universe is stress on the particular kind of formal activity at the moment. So if there is a process of rotation down here about 5 o'clock and it moves to 6 o'clock, if we looked at this and call this the historic process, remember our numbers from last time, 12 and down, and there's the 6 or sex function, and it is developing and travelling up here to try to get self-government. The forces rotating there as they travel round, viewed from inside the system by one of them, appear to be history. That is, some of these motions are involved into it and called memory, and some of them it has not yet reached, which it calls the future. It is simply travelling round there inside the cosmic substance, the sentient substance, and appearing to itself to be travelling through what it calls time. Now the word time is the word emit, if you remember, and it is measured in terms of emissions of energy. And if we marked this off in degrees, we could say that when an energy leaves this point, we'll say 7 o'clock, and appears in point 8, that the emission of energy across there is what we mean by time, because the thing is first at 7 o'clock, then at 8 o'clock. It has therefore changed its place. And change of place takes what we call time, namely energy emission. Now, we were talking before about the movement towards the centre being a movement for the good boys or the sheep, and the movement towards the perimeter for the goats or naughty boys, who, if they manage to get out, will make universes of their own outside. And from this point of view, William Blake said that people on earth are worshipping the devil under the name of Jehovah, because Jehovah himself, actually, we shouldn't pronounce it with consonants, because he's a string of vowels or free motions, and nothing constrains him. And the devil is the integration principle, which brings us on to the centre. But what drives people, as far as they believe, is the pursuit of their own end, namely the five freedoms. They believe they are looking for freedom. But if they believe that if they ever become free, they will be happy, it is ignorance. Because to be free is to be outside there and have to make yourself a universe. And you'd have to make it exactly according to this plan, because there is no other. Once you are enclosed inside a sphere, as Blake said, let God go into a sphere and see how he goes on. Once you've got outside and you've got your own sphere to make, you'll have exactly the same problem that the Creator had, because every sentient sphere must set up inside himself a rotating system in order to control the subsidiary substances and forces within his own being, because they will not like to be controlled any more than we do, who are inside the cosmic self. So we could say then that whether we're moving towards the centre or to the perimeter depends on whether we have completed a cycle of evolution. We move towards the centre when we're looking for security and feel a certain amount of dependence on some source of information, or source of food. Information is a kind of food. And when we've got it, we want to turn away and make our own centres, just like children go to the parents for food and pocket money and so on. And when they've grown up big enough, they want to go right out and make a home of their own. Now, absolutely, the absolute expects you to do that ultimately. The thing is not to run away prematurely, because if you do, you'll never get out. The thing is to drive yourself into the centre until you understand enough about your own being to be able to turn away without wanting to come back. So, whether we go towards the centre or to the perimeter depends on our level of being and how far we've gone. It's nothing at all to do with moral issues. It has to do with what we have done and understood, and whether we're going in or out now is not important, because the whole process, in any case, is cycling. Now, the name of God, as given by Plato, is Kronos. And Kronos is translated Saturn. And Saturn is the devil. And he derives it from two words. I'll put them down here. You see, Koros itself, which you can see is the same as Kuros, to run. and that Yorkshire nouse, or noose. Put these two words together, and you get chronos, chronos. And that's Saturn, time. Because as long as this rotates, there is time. Because the rotation is no more than an emission of energy from one place to another. So the very same fellow that Plato is talking about and says he's God is the fellow that we, since the rise of Christianity, have been assured is the devil. And we are assured that it is a very wicked and devilish and immoral activity to collect substance, mammon. Now, the collecting tendency is towards the centre. And the organisations that collect are, in general, two, the state and the church. They're called the right and the left. The church is supposed to be the left. It's supposed to sing you a song about why you should deliberately circumscribe yourself and donate. And the state itself really is vested in the army, which is called the right arm of the state. And between the right and the left, there is stability. Between hitting somebody with your strong right arm or stroking them with your weak left arm, stability comes. And they are both justified. The New Testament is very clear about this. There are no powers on earth, no matter how bad, that are not established from above. We can see that above means towards the centre. We talk about going up to the metropolis, don't we? And a person, from the point of view of the intelligence in the centre, pushed outwards, is said to be flung out. He's ostracised. Kick him out. He's no good for this society. So that we have two motions, a centripetal motion there and a centrifugal motion there. And those two motions are dependent entirely on the level of your understanding of yourself, which means how much you are aware of the rotation of forces, forces which are ideation or thinking, when you try to clarify them. And when you get to a certain level, you understand what that centre is about, then you are free to move along, go to the perimeter, go out if you like, and force your way in again if you like. But before you can do that, you have to have complete integration of your own being. You will never be allowed out until you have complete self-control, because you cannot get through this rotation band unless you have a terrific amount of energy, and that you cannot get unless you unify yourself. The same principle that allows an amoeba to split, a monocell to become two, and so on, is simply that the energies inside have reached a certain point where they can integrate on new centres. And when the integration power of the forces within it reaches a certain level, there are really two centres coming to be in that substance, and the two centres ratify their dual natures by splitting into two bodies. And there again it is a question of might is right. Can you do it? Might means the belly power, and right is your ruling power. If you have the prime will and you drive it up and formulate it, then you are right. And if you don't, then you will not have the might either. Because it requires terrific energy to mobilize the will in an efficient way, which is the same thing as a logical way, fundamentally. And therefore, in a true idea, you have evidence of colossal amounts of work done by some beings and handed to you through your hereditament. So at the point where you can begin to think clearly, and turn back this epistrophe of Plato, this back-turning of yourself, when you can do that, it is evidence that a few thousand years of effort has been made towards self-inhibition, self-control, and release from external control. Let's remember that outside this circle, we call it spirit as non-bound form, and ignoring it as form, washing away all forms absolutely and all considerations, we call it the absolute. Absolute means it is solved away, washed away. when all considerations are deliberately put aside, considerations, when we no longer sit things together, and we retain simply the feeling of the whole without the formal differences, we call it the absolute. If then we say of the absolute, by definition, it is not definable, which is paralogic again, because to define is to set the limits and the absolute has none, we define the absolute negatively by saying it is infinite, not finite. But when we come to consider that being infinite, we cannot deny it anything, we assert that coextensive with the infinity of the absolute, there is spirit, that is formal play of force. So that spirit means forces behaving in a formal manner. And they are coextensive with the absolute. And that same spirit it is which has, as one of its forms, the spherical rotation, the biggest one of which, when we conceive it, we call God. And considering it as substantial, we call it God's body. Considering it as a rotating system with form order in it, we call it the Lord, L-O-R-D, where L equals labor, work. And Lord means the principle of order, working. So when we remember order is ord, rota, the rotation of forces, then the whole universe, as an orderly structure, willed intelligently, is called the Lord. So we call it the body of God as substantial. We call the same thing as an orderly progression of forces, intelligently determined, the Lord. We call it God as good when we aim at it as our object of will. You know, the atheists don't call God good. They say God isn't good because we're not aiming at it. Good is the thing at which your goal, or in the case of individual human beings, gullets, the little wills aim at. So we can then see quite clearly what the theologians are really talking about. Now, the word that we often use when we're dealing with science and views of the world to put forward a view, a guess, if you like, a conjecture, or an approach to understanding, when we have no evidence externally, is called a theory. And this theory means God differentiates. A theory is that which gives you the orderly pattern of events in your logic department, in your intellect. So that to theorize is to see things the way God sees them. This is the way the Greeks understood the word theoria. Theos is God. And as God runs, the way in which he runs, that is called theoria, theory. Then there comes, out of the theory and after it, practice, which is pira actis, or the rational activity derived from a consideration of theoria. Now this is God, and the whole process, speak to me Thora, is the theoria, or running of God. And to understand that running process of force inside this cosmic body is to understand the theory of the universe. Now this word theory is frequently abused at lower levels in science, but at the top levels of really good thinkers like A.N. Whitehead, is aware that theory historically derives from this Greek concept that the way God runs, it's theos, God, and rhea, to run. You see, the way God runs round is theoria. You see, it's theory. It's God running round. And if you understand that God is force, intelligent force, the way that he runs round is the formal statement about the universe as form. And practice is pira actis, and the K in the act. We must be very careful about this. We've got this. I'll put an S in there to remind you that's gone. And that's theory. And we put a little A on the end of that, and let that Y be an I, and that's degree. The way God runs is theory. And when somebody says that's all right in theory but no good in practice, they're talking about a bad theory, a false theory. Because a good theory is one that just makes practice possible and makes it accurate. So if we understand the way God runs round, this is the way he runs round, he just does this all the time. That's theory. If we study the geometry of all the formal relations of that process, we're leaving an exhausted bit in the middle there, the centre, from which there emerges continuously force going away. And it goes back in again, all the way around. That is theory. That's what it means. Now, phira actis is phi. Phira is the basis of the pi ratio. And if we turn this I into a Y, we see the word fire, fire. Because there is no reason, as we said before, other than the will behaving formally in a certain way. So the phira and the act, I'll put a K there, there's the letter C, anciently. Without that apply, I'll put that in. Phira actis. This termination at the end is simply the issue of it. The act implies closure. Akkut. You close your gullet to do it. And phira is your reason, which is your desire, your fire, formulating itself in order to act. And the fact that that K is in there means you are not looking at the theory, because the theory is the whole. Remember on this diagram we said that this is continuously whizzing round, so that every idea is becoming every other idea all the time. This is why it is so difficult to control an argument. Why people talking about politics finish up about something totally different? Because of the inherency of ideas, which is always to become other. So, in phira actis, we are taking a closed portion, a little bit of the theory, and allowing ourselves to apply ourselves to a partial. The theory of the whole is the theory. If we talk about the theory as a whole, the Sanskrit word for it is pur na. This termination na means a serpent. Pur is the same as this. If we put this letter in Greek, it looks like that, something like our U. But it's pronounced midway between U and Y, as in U. So, in the word for stuff in Greek, if we wrote it like that in English, that Y in the middle, which would anglicise and say hana, in Greek it is hyle. And this sound, E-U, together, U, which occurs in German and also in French, is a sort of primitive sounding thing, U. It implies drive and precision simultaneously. Because the vowel E means precision and the vowel U means drive. So the sound U means precision and drive. And if you say that, put your tongue in the position of E, hold it there and then round the lips without letting the tongue fall down and say U. And you then feel somehow cheeky. If you do it, you'll feel that. Just do it, make quite sure. But don't say ooh, just no. Say E, feel where your tongue is, it's right up against the palate. Now keep it up there and then round your lips and say E. Then you say, if you drop your tongue. Say E, now keep your tongue there, E. Keep your mind on your tongue so that it doesn't fall. E, and then round your lips. E. Now you're making a difference. Now you see how hard it is to do this. In German it's easy. Everybody says U in German. They have two of these sounds, one with a U with an umlaut on it, 2 points, and then one with an O, the same. One is U, the other is U. They're both primitive sounds because the Germans are primitive people. And the French also have this U sound, and the Greeks had it. And it means precision and drive simultaneously. So in this Hüle, as stuff, it is really incorrect to translate it matter. So the philosophers say very calmly, there is no correct translation for the Greek hyle. There isn't. Because hyle is hyle. That's all there is to it. The word ghoul, the Arabic word ghoul, which is a blood-sucking spirit in the desert. Some people call it a ghoul. But really, ghoul is it's an aspirating sound. Is the same thing, because this spirit is the eater in the riddle of Samson that becomes the meat. It is a hyle. And if you make that sound properly, you'll feel primitive and yet somehow clear, clearly primitive and primitively clear. So when we come to consider this pur now, here, this pur, if we take this word on its own and put an I there, pur, it's a French word meaning ban, isn't it? It's part of that root which means ban to the French. It's ban because the French are trying to be reasonable. They're not succeeding, they're trying. So when they don't quite make the grade, they say that's bad. But as far as the real meaning of that is concerned, it means a person or a point. And remember, every point is sentient and therefore it's truly a person. There's no such thing as non-personal matter, because every point of rotation is halozoic. It is a stuff of life. And it is a self. So this pur implies a pushing and a going along and a becoming different at the same time, pur. And na is the serpent. So purna means this whole process. When we take out a little tiny bit of it, we say p, because that vowel is short, precise, and the radial activities of it, radiation from it, and the closure of the k implies that we have selected arbitrarily a little tiny bit of theory, or the total way God behaves, and we then say that we have done this for a pirai vat purpose, don't we? For a private purpose. Now this is the route to go, va, there's our reason again, punctilious reason, and the te, function at the end, means crucified on feeding. So private is the same thing as being crucified on a particular ambition. So every person with a private purpose, by definition, is doomed to fail. And therefore we say they are privated when it's taken off them, the thing that they wanted to get. So if a man like Nuffield decides he'll corner a lot, a mammon, he comes to a point where he realises that he's looking at half a circle. He will have to give it back if he wishes to get the good opinion that he wanted when he decided ambitiously to get it in order to get good opinion. Because, of course, the only reason people chase it is in order to make other people think that they're great fellows. And when they've got it, they have to give it back. So you find all the great mammon worshippers of the world, the Henry Fords or the Rockefellers or others, they collect it to build themselves up, big opinion, and then they have to give it back to the people from whom they took it in order to get their good opinion. That's dialectic. It is the natural process of events, as we saw about an idea. It passes all the way around the circle and becomes its opposite. So, when we're talking about practice, we should be very, very careful, because the less we practice, the better. Because practice implies that we have taken a little portion of the theory and applied it in a particular situation, which is privated, that is to say, deprived of the rest of it. And when we get a statement like sufficient for the day is the evil thereof, it's a statement that in a given situation, when you are required to do something, you shouldn't fall down to the level of thinking that you are applying a theory in practice. You should allow the theory to apply itself through you, and then you become a vehicle of the theory. You know, a fellow, even a little fellow like Hitler, was aware that the German soul was, in its mythic sources, Norse, and had a terrible kind of conflict between the gods and the giants, in which the gods got the worst of it, which is very strange. In German mythology, the gods get a bashing. In the Lutherdemmerung, you have the Twilight of the Gods, where the gods are fighting these very tough fellows, and they don't win. And the reason is, Teuton, Teuton, is the same thing as the voice of God. And the Germans think they are gods. And every time they have a fight, the other fellows win. And this reflects itself in the mythology. And Hitler knew that. What he didn't realize was that it is necessarily so. He thought he could capitalize on this mythology and tell the Germans that they truly were gods, but this time they were going to beat the giants. Now, he was alert enough to see that this sphere and the travelling round it of the historic process is only the development of its internal actualities. And therefore, if you tell somebody there that they can get to there, the opposite, and then get in front of them there, they will think they are following you. Now, he actually had the nerve to say so. If you've read Mein Kampf, you'll remember that he says, I will break truces and tell lies whenever necessary, and also that I will get ahead of the people in the direction I know they are going, and then they'll think that they're following me, and then they'll call me der Führer. So, if you know that there is a cyclic process, and you believe that the other people don't know it, and you go ahead in the direction that they think they are going, and you keep saying, look, I'm ahead of you, then they'll get an idea that they're following you, and eventually they'll do as they're told by the man in front. What he didn't see was the inherent processes of self-refutation, because although he got a smattering of the true meaning of the theory, yet he had not liked it for his private purpose. Certain aspects of it he did not like, and he thought that because the universe is fundamentally volitional, as Schopenhauer had taught him, therefore he could somehow by will defeat the logic of the universe, because it's only a battle of wills, isn't it? After all, it's only God, and he's a very diffuse sort of being, and myself, well, I'm terribly compacted and very sure of myself. And if you think that God is a very large and diffuse and somewhat vague old gentleman, and you're really a very vital and compacted and clever human being, it arises in your mind that you can defeat his logic, when you know that it's only will, and that one of his names is Saturn, Kronos, Father Time, the Ancient of Days. He's represented with a long beard, and he can hardly stand up. Therefore, we can easily beat him. This is the kind of process that goes on in the mind when you think about it. If you sit down and meditate on this, can I get my own way as a finite individual inside a universe which is fundamentally volitional and is only being logical on purpose? Can I understand the logic in such a way that I can defeat it? Because I know it's only being willful, really. God is willing to be God. He's not essentially God. He's just willing to be God. And just because I happen to be born inside him, he's willing to make me behave. But if I can understand the principle that he knows, surely I can defeat him. Well, of course, it's bad reasoning, because if you understand the principle that he knows, the best you can get out of that game of chess is a stalemate. So, we have the whole process here, and this concept of privation, of being deprived of the whole of your understanding, by deliberately choosing a particular, should be considered very seriously. Because most people find that their occupations have been chosen for them by someone else. And very, very few people are quite satisfied with the position they have been given. If we take a middle-class family as an example, where a certain amount of social uplift has appeared in them, so that they want their children to have it better than they did, as they say, and they don't want the children to have to go and work like ordinary folk, so they work themselves very hard, send them to a university, and then they think, now what can we do with him? How bright is he? He doesn't understand mathematics or something, so he can't be a scientist. He doesn't understand anything much, you see. So after much thought, they'll push him in a given direction where his inherent weaknesses, as they see them, make it possible for them to push him, and they might finish up by saying, well, he's no good for science or politics, he can't go in the government, he can't understand anything. And in the end, perhaps he can't get through 6-year studies in the medical course and so on. The fellow's no good, so we'll let him go in the church. Now, that's a very common analysis, because you don't have to know, really, very, very much, know to go in that direction. And there's only one thing lower than that, and that is saying the fellow's no good at all, let him be an artist. And this is always a movement towards lifting the person up a bit, which exposes him to situations which he himself has not made with his own will. And therefore his will, which is one of these little twizzling things here, is continuously trying to make up its mind whether it ought to go to the centre and be good, as it says, and his own very universal rule, or whether it should run the other way and finish up in Adelaide House. The choice is there, and the choice is always, shall I go to the centre or to the perimeter? Am I going to obey cosmic law or disobey it? And all the laws that are established on Earth are established from above, that is, from the centre, because all form, as we see in this diagram, is continuously spinning out of the centre to the perimeter. So the centre is the source, the wellspring from which everything comes. Now, if we go towards that, deliberately, we're doing a very strange thing, because all the forces that are emerging from there are flinging us to the centre. But they're coming out of the centre. And they're flinging us to this perimeter here, and making a little centre on the perimeter for us, because they turn as they go, all these processes. It appears that the central force that orders us wants us to get into trouble, because all the trouble occurs on the perimeter. This means to say that the government of the world, the government of cosmos, is driving us out to our sense organs all the time, where we will get into trouble. This is why Christ, when he's asked to give a type of prayer, gives them the Lord's Prayer, and puts in the Lord's Prayer a very funny thing that a lot of ministers don't like, where you pray to God the Father, "Oh, lead us not into temptation," which makes God a kind of devil. But the point is, a lot of weak people who haven't had much experience say, if it is true that the universe is orderly and we cannot get away with willfulness, well then we're going to be clerks for the system. We're going to find out what the orders are and obey them. And if they manage to do that and go prematurely to the centre, they'll constitute a little bureaucratic wall round the centre, and they'll remain profoundly ignorant and keep passing the orders from centre over themselves to the other fellows on the outside who can't fill in the forms. And in order to make sure that those beings do not become static and fail to evolve, this force from the centre is continuously flinging people out to the perimeter into experience. And this is in experience that we discover that we don't know things. And this makes us more and more and more desire to know things in order to control ourselves, to release ourselves from the determination and dominion of forces outside ourselves that we don't like. So that if we could, like little babies, always have mummy and always stay little so that we could be nursed forever, we would do so. But because this central force is swinging out all the time, babies grow up. They can cry like mad, but their legs get longer every day. And ultimately they find they can pick a spoon up and shovel it in. They still want to go back where they were the first time. And mummy says, like Kierkegaard says, she has to paint the breast black so that we'll begin not to like it. Otherwise it will never go away. Because if we could get things laid on as it was in utero, in heaven, then we'd stay there. But the central force, the creative force of the universe, is continuously spinning us out into experience, which is the same as time play or temptation. And it is God, the creator, who is flinging us into the time, and yet time is Saturn, Chronos, the devil. So it is God who is throwing us into temporal experience, which is the zone of temptation. But the whole process is so that we shall leave nothing undone, and ultimately shall have full understanding of our own possibilities, and then we will be fit for freedom. Free dome. To be able freely to dome ourselves, to rule ourselves.
So well, why do we pray in that state not to be led into it, if we see at the moment the benefit of it?
Well, it's a matter of logic, you see. Supposing you said, lead me into temptation, you'd be talking about a bias in yourself, wouldn't you?
Mm.
Now, unless we can get an opposition, we cannot grow. Unless we get a force acting like this, supposing there's the earth, that's matter, that's blocked. If we lay two sticks and press them very hard, they'll stand up like that, won't they? So the elevation of a being depends on forces in opposition. So we have to pray against our inclination to get the opposition. So if we were already wanting to go into temptation, and we said to God, please lead us into temptation, when we're already going, we're saying, don't oppose us. But it's only through the opposition that we can elevate ourselves. So if we tend not to go into temptation, we want pushing, really. Because we've already been hurt, we don't want to have any more to do with it. On the other hand, if we are liking it, we need opposing. So you don't lead us into temptation, we're already going that way. You see? Push us the other way. We want the opposition. Like Blake says, opposition is through friendship. This question of opposition must be understood very carefully, because if it is, you will move in a totally different way from your ordinary way of moving, because you will always look for opposition. Not stupidly, but you will look for the kind of opposition that you are strong enough to put up with for the time being. And as that opposition comes and you overcome it, you are then stronger and you can deal with the next opposition. But you will begin to look for opposition, because you cannot grow without it. Just like a little boy, as soon as he can stand up, he'll start trying to lift up a stone. It's too heavy for him. And if he doesn't try to lift something slightly too heavy, well, then he won't lift something heavier later. When he feels the pain in his muscles, he doesn't stop. The drive is in him. He can conquer it. Will, it's got to come up. And it's this determination in the individual, which looks like individual will, which is the cause of the evolution and the integration of that same individual will later. So that we can't even call individual willfulness absolutely bad. You see, the whole of moral thought does not apply to the evolving person, because he may have to do anything in order to integrate himself. But the thing he mustn't do is follow his inclination, because there's no opposition. Subject to the great law, don't damage your vehicle. Find out what you don't want to do. Find out your inclination and always stop it. We must be very careful that we don't do something stupid and say that we didn't feel inclined to do it, therefore we did it. What we want to find out is existing inclinations, not fabricated ones, and simply stop them. Not do something else. Stop that inclination. And then when we're quite free of inclination, we are then an upright man, for the time being, we can then decide in which direction to go next, in order to expose ourselves to a new temptation. So we've got here a very simple diagram of the universe, or of a single cell, or of a human being with this as his skin surface, and all the processes going on inside his body. And the same rule applies to anything whatever. And the concept of theory in its true origin is the form of the whole, and anything less than the form of the whole is not really theory. Therefore, in the harmonizing of the sciences, what they are looking for today is what they call the great synthesis. The law that is so big that it covers all the apparent exceptions of the individual sciences. Because there are laws in parts of science today that are not true in other parts. Thus the laws of Daltonian chemistry are not true of subatomic particles. There is a big law that covers all laws, and that law is the true meaning of the word theory. And if we take less than that and try to apply it privately, we are automatically deprived of the benefit of the whole theory and must make an error. Error means running away from the whole. And in the error we must suffer a damage, a damn age, an age when we are damned, stopped, and in that damning we must rotate and discursively reason why we have been defeated. And the answer is always the same: we were acting partially, privately, and therefore in a deprived way, instead of using the whole. And if we realize that if we put our consciousness with the whole, the whole has already got what we call the perfect act for any part of itself at any moment of history. Supposing it takes for the precession of the equinoxes and the turning of the houses of the zodiac 25,000 years to make one cycle. It means that there is something that can be done in each period. You know that we've just come to a period of strikes, haven't we? The planet Saturn has a periodicity of just about 30 years or less. In 1926, 30 years ago, strikes. This is caused by a certain kind of vibration that emanates from the centre of precipitation of Saturn and spreads right through the universe, and when it comes into conjunction with certain other forces, it acts on the Earth in such a way that individuation, which is the Saturnine complex, individuation then appears to be very important. So then individuals and groups, which are larger individuals, start demanding what they think are their legitimate rights. And they think they are doing it freely, but they're really doing it as a purely automatic response. In exactly the same way that if you put a seed in the ground 2 days before the full moon, it will come up better than one put 2 days after the full moon. Because the moon draws water to it, and it makes the seed absorb and fatten up and burst and germinate very quickly. And the two processes suggest a mechanical. So, if we consider this as a world soul, and we consider the formal relations of it, when we consider the necessity of form within it, because it rotates, we are considering the mechanic of it. So the universe, considered as a series of related forms, is mechanical. But so to consider it is abstract thought, because those related forms are not really separate at all. And if we think that they are distinct and not really different, we mean doing differently. Different is difacere, doing different, doing two. If we think they are distinct with a K in, that is cut off from each other, we are deceived. So if we think that the universe is merely mechanical, we are deceived, because the mechanical analysis of the universe is an abstract analysis where we deliberately pretend that the universe is not a whole but is made up of a series of parts. And all the parts in the universe are simply little rotations of the one force in that big spinning sphere. When we consider the whole sphere as form, solidly packed with form, we call it the Sophic sphere, the sphere of wisdom. If we consider it as substantial plastic substance with form in it, we call it Sophia, the goddess. When we think about it as made of plasticity, clay, which is earth and water put together, we say it is feminine. If we thought about it in terms of air and fire, we say it is masculine. So if we think about the fiery and aerial or initiative and intellectual activities, we call it God, the Father, Son. But if we think about it as plastic substance, water and earth, then we call it God the Mother, or a goddess. Well, of course, the S of the end means this watery flow from it. In the Indian pantheon, you have Vishnu himself, who represents preservative justice, and his consort Lakshmi, who represents mercy. Mercy is simply the fact that the energy flows from one place to another. So just when you can't bear it anymore, on a Monday, suddenly it's Tuesday. It means so much energy has flowed. This is Lakshmi. See, lok, locality. This lok means place, like the word lock, which implies it. So Lakshmi means overflowing the place. So there's always an end to it. It doesn't matter what they do to you. You can say, in 10 years' time, what will I think about it now? Some people say, it isn't 10 years yet. Already it's today. The toothache is now. Well, never mind. When you're 90, you'd be glad of that tooth, even if it ate. You see, and so on. And this is a climbing out of the merely local. And this leakage of energy out of the local is called Lakshmi, which is the concept of Vishnu, who is the preserving true judge, logic of the universe. We can equate, if we like, the preserver with the Logos as this rotating orderly system, the Lord. Actually, if we look at the Hindu Trinity, yeah, a series of gods, and we'll see their anagram there from the same one. There are three gods, and
and they're made out of the same letters. Now this Ishvara is the creator. You put the vowel on the end there so you can say it. Ishvara is creator. Vishnu is preserver. And Shiva is destroyer. Now, we had an emperor called Constantine, who in the 4th century became the first official convert to Christianity in order to pacify his empire, because the Christians were so busy fighting each other about their dogmas that they were cutting the place to bits. So he said, if I become a Christian, then I shall tell them to shut up. So he became a Christian and then told them, come to a conclusion quickly, you are disrupting the empire. And his proof that he should do it was a vision. When he saw a cross, and it went like this. He said that he saw a cross in the sky, like the sky flowers and the moon. And he said, this is Latin. In hoc signo vinces. In this sign shall you triumph. And the Hebrew is Yod Hei Shin Vav or Yehoshua, Jesus. So the very same form of four letters is the Jesus of the Christian, the Jesus, or affirmative horse, or if you want something doing, do it yourself. And the Latin in hoc signo vinces, in this sign shall you triumph. There are other ways of saying this rather rudely by the opponents, but I won't say what those are. Ish va, ish is the same as ish, issue in English, to come out, and vi, to develop. Ish va, to come out and develop, the creator. The ish, go in again, you see. Ish is preserve, keep this developing, going. So this one and this one are like this. And then Shiva means to let this spirit from outside cross the whole thing off. So in the middle of his forehead you find the god Shiva has an eye, or the eye of Shiva. The pineal gland is related to it in a certain way, that vestigial eye, that atrophied third eye. Shiva means to just cross it off. And it's the same being, namely spirit. This means punctilious, separating spirit development. This means this developing, persisting spirit. This means this separating spirit goes on to that point and just takes it to bits, solves it, washes it away. And it is all the same fellow. And it is all the same fellow with the one we call Jesus, which is Yasus, affirmation, which saves you, to affirm. At one point in your evolution, you should go into the center, affirm the center, in order to learn the law. When you have learned the law, then you should affirm the other way. But you should never move negatively. And two negatives make a positive. So if you never move negatively, you should be moving positively. So you should decide whether you know enough about cosmic law or don't. If you don't, then find out. And the only way you can find out is by obeying it, because you can never find out by disobeying it, just precisely what it is. All you can find out by disobeying it is what it is not, and that isn't good enough. Now, we said in this case that from the center spins out a force and is continuously carrying us into temptation. And we have to think of our evolution in terms, in this period, which is called the Kali Yuga, the Black Age, the Age of Iron, of violence, and of industrial revolution, and so on. In this Kali Yuga, what we have to do is try and drive into the center of our beings, because the forces are trying to push us out. And it is only through opposition that we can grow. And it isn't that we want to get into the center prematurely, but it's that if we go the other way, we will not get the opposition we need. So if we go to town and paint it red and so on, we are not transcending ourselves, we're going the other way. The temptation, the pushing of us to the perimeter of our being, is only to serve as a counterstroke so that we can exert pressure against it. If we don't have this outflow that's carrying us into the five sense world and work against it, we cannot evolve. If we go with it, we can't evolve. We can only go down the drain. Now, if we allowed ourselves to go down the drain and wait a few thousand years, the movement will be going the other way. If we stay down the drain, it'll be hard work, because when it starts going back, it's very, very hard. So we have this twofold motion problem, but for us, in our period, the whole of the motion is symbolized in the fish called the salmon. The salmon is not the twig. The twig is going downstream, which in this diagram is out. The salmon is almost jumping up, but swimming against the stream to get to the source. And that's why we find those three symbols in the Christian Celtic Trinity of the fool, the salmon, and the goose. Where the, remember, the goose is a symbol of reincarnation. It's a white migratory bird. Means the pure soul becoming a fool, and then a salmon striving back. So to be the fool for Christ's sake, as we've said, is always to go against that which most people are going for. Simply because you get more opposition that way, and you can only grow by opposition. So that we shouldn't want to arrive prematurely, but we should try as hard as we can to get into the centre, which means to obey cosmic law. And cosmic law is very, very simple. It says, the one contains in it the many. And because the many are only modalities of the one, then the many must be treated as if they are the one, because they are the one modalized. So when it says love God, that's the one, and the neighbor is yourself, that's the many. That is the law, and the rest is commentary. And this is the opposition we need, because we have no tendency to do it. We have no tendency to love all, so we can get the opposition out of trying to. It doesn't matter whether we succeed or not. What matters is that we try, because we're looking for the opposition which alone can integrate us. So that as far as we're concerned, in this Black Age, this Carling, you've got this Iron Age of violence and invention, the whole of our problem is how to behave as if people were not separate. When all their behaviour, which is perimeter behaviour on this diagram, all their behaviour says that they are separate. We needn't be scared stiff of people suddenly reforming us and depriving us of the exercise of loving our enemies. They won't be doing it for some time yet. Now, I haven't got any particular points in here that are not quite clear.
Well, there's one thing that arose after something you said there, quite surprising really. You spoke about small wills will obscure ideas for you. And you said it was concerned with not wanting to be controlled. Now, could an external situation that has happened to you make a difficulty for you if you're trying to get control internally?
Oh, yes. What you are calling an external situation shows that you have forgotten this diagram. I think I'll let you draw that. Good night. Good night. There's our universe again. There is nothing external to it. There is no thing external to it. External to it is not a thing, it is absolute spirit. So that all problems are internal. All these forces are whizzing round inside here, and one of them is you, but it's only a little turn. It's like that. Something is going in and something is going out. You call it food and stimulus going in, excrement and action going out. And that is just an enlargement of that. Now you're talking about an external situation acting upon you and making difficulties for you on the inside. You can only be talking about some of the other motion that this belongs to, can't you? Coming into you and making it difficult for you to decide just whether you're doing this or not.
Well, I can say that the situation I found myself in was one that at the time gave me a very rough time. And I think it made me slightly anti towards authority. So much so that I think that I have attempted to either evade or oppose the grip of authority. Because what happened to me was that I found myself in a position at the age of 14 where, as far as authority was concerned, no matter what I did, I was wrong. And it was very, very difficult for me at the time. I can explain it further by saying that a situation happened which a lot of people wanted to know about. If I was the most available to be asked, and if I was asked, I'd done wrong by telling them. If I didn't tell them, I was bad as far as they were concerned because I wasn't letting on. But the result that I was as though I was in a trap, and if I did tell them, I always found myself in extreme difficulties because I had told them. So I started to evade direct questions like that by not giving the full facts. I don't think I've ever given the full facts on things since. I always deflect, with the result that I have found since that people will come to you with an idea of you in their mind, and from that idea they will attempt to find out more about you. But if you allow them to think that their idea is the right one, they've then got the wrong one and you've deflected them from it. And I think that has perhaps been the sort of thing that when I start to think about this work, I get so far and then all sorts of vagaries come out. I can't grasp the
thing. You see, supposing this is a diagram of you, and this now represents a little idea in you. And that little idea was a secret. But in this diagram, there is another being out here knocking on you and saying, tell me that secret. But there's another being outside here saying, don't you tell that secret. If you do tell it, you please this one and annoy that one. If you don't tell it, you please that one and displease that one. You're in the middle in all such problems. Now, the point was, it was a temptation. It was a temporal presentation, but you didn't understand that at the time. What you did was try to compromise between those two in the same way that the heart tries to compromise between the head and the belly. And it's a legitimate analysis at that stage. But now you can transcend that by looking at it in another way. Each one of those has exactly the same problem that you've got. Namely, forces turning round which have to be put in order. If you let that one know, this one has a problem of equilibration. If you refuse to let that one know, that one's problem is found here. So the question is, what should you do? What is your governing concept for dealing with two people, one of whom wants to know something to balance himself, which will depend on unbalancing another being, and the other one wants you not to let that be known, so that that can be balanced at the expense of that? What should you do about it? Can you see your governing concept that you need?
That's wanted, isn't it?
If we open this diagram by taking a snippet out here, make a pyramid, and say down there there's a lot of people we call impulses, up there there's a few administrators, and on the top there's a king. And that king can only keep his position if somebody in the middle keeps these people down below in order. But if he's a good king, he doesn't want to be bothered by these people. Because it's not worth being a king if you've got to keep your ministers ministered to, is it? So what you want to do is set up a shield here, like the cabinet, and then another shield like the Privy Council, and then Parliament, and so on. These shields are doing the work of frightening all the forces below, so that that fellow at the top can do nothing. They sit there and eat his lorry. And that's the idea, isn't it? Because the centre of your being should be still. Because if there isn't something still in you, you're going to be in a mess and you can't judge properly. And your perimeter won't be still because it's constantly being stimulated from outside. So you want the centre to be still. So you have to consider the relation there. Internally, we can say it's the relation between this part of yourself to this and this. When a being is in a certain position, he needs temptation of a certain order. He needs to be presented with a problem of the kind that you are presented with, to see what he will do with it. And according to what he does with it, so will be the thing that happens to him next. So if without hesitation, a gentleman asks, where is so-and-so? He committed the robbery last night, and you say, he's in the Blue Unicorn down the corner now, without hesitation. Well, you're sort of demoted, because you haven't even had the beginnings of an epistrophic process. You didn't reflect. So you'll be pushed down a bit lower. The next test you get will be on a lower level. So if you want a higher test, you look at the situation, and you don't give that information to the authorities, even though you know very well that the whole stability of the king, God bless his soul, rests on it. Because you say, sorrow must come, and woe to him by whom, and I'm moving out. Get your information from another bloke who needs a lesson. Now when you become very, very clear about that, you will not tell any authority, you will never be stool-pigeon about anything, because there is always another one who needs a lesson more than you do, and out of the generosity of your heart, why should you deprive it? And if you think about it that way, the test shuffles down the scale, down this pyramid, right to the bottom level. This is what Christ meant when he said, when he's coming into Jerusalem, and they're all shouting and saying, oh, the Messiah's here. And somebody complains and says, what are all these people shouting this nonsense? He said, if they didn't shout, the stones would cry out. If you don't blow the gas, somebody at a lower level will. And if all people were strong enough not to tell, then the plants would have to start pointing. And you went that way. If they resisted it, stones would have to roll and say, follow me. That's the meaning of the elevation of the universe, the dominion that Adam was supposed to exercise. To put all the dirty jobs down at the bottom. Actually, we find a lot of people fairly near the top that will do dirty jobs, and then they get demoted for it. We find little fellows like Bevan doing a dirty job now in order to climb up. Bevin did another one. Ramsay MacDonald did one, and it's got a stinking reputation ever since. You see, when they do a dirty job that's way below their own level, they only prove that they never should have been up, really. That somehow they were flung up suddenly. They didn't get up by integration. They got up by social climbing in contact. And it isn't good enough. So you've got a very, very simple test case there. Everything you analyse is in terms of you. Any people outside yourself are just aspects of your own being, because in this big diagram we said that the form is always becoming all forms, all the time, and therefore every person is every other person as well as himself. And therefore, if you meet a certain man, you've already got that man inside yourself, otherwise you couldn't respond.
You couldn't even respond to temptation if you hadn't got the impulse to do so. So you shift the problem from outside to inside. So if a fellow comes to you and said, where is so-and-so? You look for him inside yourself and say, yes, where is he? And the fellow outside thinks you're a bit dull. I must tell you an amusing incident that happened last week. We went to see the Ten Commandments on Friday night. And while we were there, paying myself, John Jellett and Donald, we went in John's car, and we put the car on the park. While we were in the cinema seeing the Ten Commandments, some local robbers borrowed John's car, went up to Cheatham, did a robbery with it, disposed of the stuff and put it back on the car park all within 3/4 of an hour. So when some eyewitnesses saw the car and gave the number to the police and described the men, 3 men and a girl, men with beards or stubbly chins, the police followed John going home and caught him up, cross-questioned him, and he is supported by the police, and it's quite possible in his excitement said that he had been to see War and Peace. We'd been discussing very long films before he went home. They then came round to me to check his story, and when they told me, I burst out laughing and said to the detective, do you think a fellow who's 6 feet 5 inches tall, that's what John is, with a full beard and a car of that vintage with a high back and as long as a bus would go in for robberies? And the detective got very, very annoyed because I wasn't taking his dignity properly, you see. And he said, at the moment it's only a larceny case, but it could go to our higher court if we don't settle it. All I did with him was joke about it all the time and described just how stupid it would be for a fellow like me and a fellow like John Jellett to indulge in that sort of thing in that kind of car, you know. Really, I wasn't answering any of his questions that he wanted. I was talking in a very light manner about it and poo-pooing it and saying, I said, we could have been guilty. I mean, all sorts of funny things crossed his mind at times. It happened on this occasion that it was not so. And when I said we've been to see the Ten Commandments, he goes, how silly it lies. And they're still not satisfied, so John is still under suspicion. Now, the point is that if you can keep your sense of humour, and humour is HMR, fundamentally, which is the same thing as your spirit, is occupying your substance and lifting it, differentiating it, so you can see all the possibilities. If you only see one or two possibilities and those bad ones, you are said to be depressed. But if you see a lot of possibilities, you feel much lighter about it. And you do not have to respond to a stimulus at a level that the presenter of the stimulus wants you to. You can respond at another level by simply saying, well, I've got a policeman inside me. I know what it's like. The fellow who would join the police force and spend his time bucking up defenceless robbers who are quite obviously not habilitated properly is a bad impulse, you see. What would I do with it internally? The answer is I wouldn't give it an inch. And yet they exist on the outside, all right? Let them exist on the outside. Sorrow must come, and no doubt robberies must be done. But they don't have to be done by me, nor stopped by me. It's a problem for some other beings. And when we can see that these external problems have to be solved inside by us first, then we're understanding what the world is about. Because every part of that Sophic sphere is stimulating every other part so that all parts can understand the whole possibilities of the whole. And that gives tolerance. Tolerance is what the engineers call giver. It's a bit of space in between where you put the oil that enables the machinery to run.
One of the remarkable things that, came to me out of this idea of, allowing people to have their own idea of you instead of telling them what you were like or anything like that, was that you could tell where it would go and who would bring it back. You could follow people through with it. You could tell who had told who what, because it was their idea and not your idea. You start to trace of it somehow.
You have to be very careful about that, because you can get a sort of lower fourth form devil's attitude towards it, of sniggering about your capacity for seeing which way it went. You can start working at a petty devil's level of deliberately not saying things in order to see what happens. In fact, you can even go worse. You can start saying things that are not true to particular people that you know are weak, knowing that they will recite them to another person and there'll be trouble. You've got to continuously restate that you are supposed to be integrating you, and that everything that happens to you from outside happens because you are at a certain level. If you respond to the external situation in the right way, your next test will be higher, more worthwhile. If you respond badly, you'll be demoted. You'll get a lower and lower test. And this is a question of selecting the right kind of test, because a lot of tests are presented to you simultaneously. If you go down the road, there's an opportunity for a smash and grab there. There's a lady there trying to cross the road, and she's got rheumatism in both ears, and you've got to get her across the road. Meanwhile, there's a little thing tripping along that might be more appreciative of aid. You're presented with a lot of things at once. And when you understand that everything you do to the external world is done to the internal equivalent, you can only integrate yourself in a certain way. And you will then deliberately select the thing that will elevate you most surely. Well, your vision, your intelligent appraisal of the real situation. You can't see that unless you're in a real situation. You make a hypothetical situation, you will make a hypothetical reply. Yes.
Can I have a go?
Yes, do.
2 weeks ago, you gave us the Greek pi to represent division.
Yeah.
I've also got the Greek theta, which is actually the same thing the other way up.
Yes.
Actually, one on its side.
Yes.
Can you put the two together and call them the crossing first? Implying intelligent will and passive.
You can do that very easily. The origin of the whole alphabet is there.
Yeah.
Now, if we take this one out, it is the first letter of philosophy. It means analysis. But analysis is death to your will, because when you divide an idea into its constituents, you cut the whole will. But if you take out this one and put it that way, that's the Greek theta, which is the first letter of the Greek word for death, thanatos. And they used to mark men that were ready for capital punishment with that sign.
Yeah.
And that is the sign of passivity, isn't it? The horizontal. And that is the sign of activity, the vertical. So when you're actively engaged dividing, that's the philosophy. But when you're passively divided, you're a dead man. And both derive from this, active, passive.
Yes, now what I really thought there was the fact that theory and philosophy is, I'm having a go at the sign being the first letter of philosophy.
Yeah.
And the theta being the first letter of theory.
Yes.
Now I want to know how they are opposed to one another. Theory and philosophy.
Well, you know, some people say that theory is dead.
Yes.
Don't they? Now, that is an initiation statement from long ago, which survives in an ordinary expression, in ordinary everyday speech. Because the theory of the thing is the whole, isn't it?
Yes.
And the theory, being whole, is absolutely unalterable. There can be nothing new in it. And the absolutely unalterable is said to be dead.
Yeah.
You see that? We, in German, we get sterben zu leben. Die in order to live. Get your theory right so that your life process can be right. But your theory is dead, I hope. Because if you had a theory that wasn't dead,
It would keep changing. We'd have to keep relearning it. What we want is something that is absolute for all worlds. Like Richard II in jail, hammering out on his brain with his soul for a hammer the structure of the universe.
Would you say stable then? Stable.
Stability, yes. So the idea of death is really the idea of equilibrium, of stability. The idea in physics of entropy. Entropy is the dead state when all the forces of the universe are equilibrated. The Sanskrit term for it is pralaya, which means the reason laying down. And when the whole process is done, they call it the mahapralaya, which is the great reason lying down. It's the same concept. Dead is finished, completed, no change. This is why Paul says there is no death. O death, where is thy sting? Because although there is a whole reason, the purna, or the theory of the universe, which cannot change, yet the application of that in the time process means unending change. World without end. Actually, that word theta itself means God crucified. Just like this other one is the root of love, philos. Because you have then the circle and the force penetrating it in order to produce a system.
With the two together?
Well, the two together is the same as life and death.
Yeah.
Active, passive. The circumscribed and the non-circumscribed. The quarter, the four parts of your being.
Changed and changeless.
Yeah. See, in the paralogic, you take all these things to bits and you put them all back again. And remember that they all imply each other. Doesn't matter what word you start with, really. If you define a word, you'll have to use other words.
Yes.
In fact, you'll have to use the whole of your vocabulary adequately to define one word. Lewis Carroll was well aware of this as a logician and theologian. He said, making Humpty Dumpty say it, sitting on the wall, between being and non-being, there's the wall. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Now, the king's horses and the king's men are inside that circle. Humpty Dumpty is sitting on the wall, and Alice is the soul. And Humpty Dumpty says, I make words do what I want them to do. But some of them are rather awkward.
Alice is all eyes, isn't it? All eyes, Alice, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Which is the same thing as the panops, the old panops, which is the universal I, which is many one, one many, simultaneously. It is the cosmic soul which contains all other souls in it as attributes. Humpty Dumpty makes words mean what he wants them to mean. That's the same as private purpose. But he says some of them are very, very awkward. And the awkward ones, I have to pay them extra. Now, paying them extra means if you falsely define a word, you will have to define some other words falsely to bolster up the first one. That's called paying extra. While he's busy explaining how clever he is and the promise that's been made, he falls off the wall and breaks in bits. In other words, he gets inside this rotor, which is a centrifuge, and he's flung to bits. And the king's horses and the king's men cannot put him together again because he's inside there. He's Humpty, which is the spirit, substantialized, posited and crucified, and Dumpty, flung in. Remember that in all those nursery rhymes, fairy stories, myths and so on, you've got the same cosmic thing all the time presented to you. In the children's hour the other day, they had a puppet play of the Sleeping Beauty. Again, the Sleeping Beauty is the soul. And a wicked witch, which is the same thing as the unreformed Magdalene, if you like, the belly urge, gets that soul and said, I will kill you. But that is its antithesis. There is a good friend that said, you won't, you'll only put her to sleep for 100 years. And 100 is 10 times 10. And 10 means ordinal perfection. And 100 means ordinary perfection, a lot of it. In the Bible, when it says 1,000, it means a bit too much of it. 1,000 means multiplication of details. Petty niggling in bureaucratic form for them. We would say it's 1,000. A 100 is enough, not too little, of ordinal perfection. And at the end of that time, when the soul has got ordinal perfection in its sleep, which means a sleep of daily experience, which people think is being awake, then there comes the prince, who is the first, the prince is the first state, who is, as male, the logos, the original logos, which then enters into the time process in the soul, because the soul has now got ordinal perfection. Whereupon then the soul wakes up and the whole process is carried on and the wicked witch's curse is dissolved. Now every fairy story says the same story, just disguised in any country.
I like things to be comfortable, you see. Mm-hmm. I like to think that... at least I used to like to think that God was a supernatural being that I was close to, wasn't it? And I used to like to think that the idea of life was harmonious. Now, I wanted to ask you, although you've partly answered, as you progress towards integration, should your health and your ordinary external circumstances improve, or should they represent a series of tests to you?
Well, you know, health is wholeness. And man hasn't got it. And until the whole of humanity is integrated, then no single one of them can be fully integrated. Because as we've said before on that diagram, every person is all. And the disturbances emanating from some affect all. So if there are, it's like in the body, if you get to... Well, a tiny bit of indigestion makes you feel depressed, doesn't it? A local inflammation, like a boil or something, can make you feel depressed. It's not much, but it affects the whole body. In the same way, one sick man in the universe makes the whole universe not quite right. Now, God is the universal soul. He is a person. He does care for everything that's inside it. But everything inside it is still free to do what it wants within the framework of being. And he's determined to make them harmonious. But he's determined not to use a violent method of getting harmony, but to leave it to the automatic free will of beings within himself to react on each other, and so, by consciously facing their problems, to become more and more aware of the necessity for universal harmony before an individual can complete his process. Thus it is said of Buddha that he said, I will not go into nirvana until everybody else is in. He meant to say that he was suddenly aware that the universe being one fundamental continuous substance, peace is impossible for anyone till all had got it. God's compassion, the fact that God incarnates and becomes crucified, is only evidence that God felt something going on that necessitated compassion. You cannot expect to go through your life steadily improving in health, wealth, late rising and lots of money and so on. All the so-called mammon objects do not automatically accrete to you if you start being good. A terrible thing could happen to you if you thought that was so, because you could then start attracting those material goods, including physical health. And you could find yourself with a very, very bad problem. Namely, the problem that you would have to face if you became so healthy that everybody you had ever known had died and left you in a world where nobody knew you, and you were healthy and old and outdated, anachronistic, talking nonsense, and you prayed for death. Every test has to be taken at its own level. And you mustn't expect to be ill, and you mustn't expect to be well. Those are irrelevant.
Because being ill is only a disequilibrium through which you go. And being well is a temporary state for us in the time process.
Can I question you?
Yes.
That, in a lot of cases we make our soul ill, don't we? By wrong attitude.
Do you mean freely?
By a wrong attitude to life we may attract bad influences, so-called bad influences to the body.
Oh, yes.
And that as we grow wise, we actually stop doing the thing that attracts that ill health or that lack of money, which isn't really necessary. For a start, we would start behaving in a manner that wouldn't attract too much ill health anyhow.
By definition of too much. But how much would be too much, you can't say.
The point is this, that once you know what you're doing, there's certain alterations going to be made, perhaps.
Once you know what you're doing, 100% and all the time, you're beyond the level of accident, aren't you?
Yes.
And when you get there, let me know. Because until then, you will know only so much. And the part you don't know will always be putting you in a situation which you'll have to face.
Well, let's look at it this way. A psychiatrist says, okay, forget so-and-so and get rid of your rheumatics, you see. So you do, and you get rid of the rheumatics, and this is a known case.
Hmm.
Now, in that particular way, you've actually accreted a little better health, haven't you?
You may not have done. You might have got rid of one symptom and showed another one. Supposing you say to somebody, forgive that person in order to get rid of your rheumatism.
Mm.
That's a terribly selfish motive.
I find things as they are a little bit unbearable, actually. I don't like things.
That's a negative, it won't do. You see, the only reason we should integrate is because when we have integrated, it'll take the weight off everybody else, as well as us. Because the whole process is one. If we're not careful, we can make a terrible error of trying to become perfect in order to avoid difficulty. And that isn't what we want to be perfect for. What we want to be perfect for is so the difficulties don't bother us, whatever they are. We should be able to go in an eternal evolving world with new souls continuously coming in and suffering, and we should be so integrated that we don't care if we go down into hell to help some of them that are going a bit backsliding, to start coming out. Because we've transcended the idea of passive active or suffering or joying and so on. If we get the wrong motive, we'll get the wrong result. You see, about the will, we have a very, very simple test. Either we like it or we don't. About ideas, they're very complex. About the will, either I like it or I don't. If you move because you don't like something, it is negative. You've got to have your will directed towards a worthwhile positive.
Well, the point is this, you see, I mean, one can be so frightened of annihilation, you see, that death may bring, that he couldn't possibly do any good at all until he got rid of that notion.
Well, if a man believes that he is annihilated at death, he's suffering from an erroneous idea, isn't he?
I suppose you're not sure, you see. I mean, everybody's been telling me that there's a North Pole, but I've never been there. I've got to accept it, you see, on faith, you see, that they didn't cheat me.
Well, tell me, why do you believe there's a North Pole when you've only been told and you've not been?
As I said, because there's certain people who have been taught to trust as being authority on certain subjects, and therefore I've got to take the word for it because of the overwhelming number of these authorities.
Do you know, the other night on TV there was a programme about evolution. Did you see it?
No.
And beforehand they said, we are going to present a programme that proves that Darwin was right. The actual differences between Darwin's evolutionary theory and the theories of others were not discussed. But an embryo was showed with grooves in it, and it said, these are not the gill slits of a fish, but they're in the same place and they are like them, therefore men came from fish. That isn't good logic. And he'd already shown a lizard with five thingamabobbies, four toes like fingers, and various other things with five, a seal. Why didn't he say men came from lizards or seals? If a point of similarity is a proof of origin, why doesn't he say that they came from us? Because we've got them.
It hasn't been proved scientifically that man is a later thing. He might have been hiding all the time. You see, there was a bias. It's the modern bias that we call the will to improve, which postulates that a long time ago people were tremendously ignorant and had very little brains. When they examined the skull of the Aurignacian man and found that it was bigger than that of a modern average man and very well shaped, they were startled. They still haven't quite accepted it. That the fellow was not stupid. He was a very clever fellow. And he was contemporary with another fellow who was stupid and who was eliminated, like the Neanderthal man. They want to believe that once upon a time things were stupid and they gradually improved until we arrive. This is called the myth of continuous progress. It ignores the fact that the universe is round, that everything is cyclic, and that when it reaches its term it disappears. If people are as intelligent as most of the Huxley brand would like to pretend, then to talk about fear of accidentally releasing atom bombs is rubbish. Some Americans take a plane over the North Pole and nearly frighten the Russians, and some Russians fly about and nearly frighten the Americans. And then they said the other day, if it happens that some of their men and some of our men happen to be flying towards each other, they might think it's an attack. They start dropping things. And the real danger of the moment is fear that somebody might drop a bomb, because somebody may drop a bomb if they're afraid. Is that a sign we've improved? It isn't a sign at all. There's no integration of any magnitude in human beings on the whole. The few who've got it don't get themselves involved in that sort of scrape.
Did they integrate for the purpose of integrating? Did it happen as a byproduct of trying to help humanity? Which came first?
Now that's very, very important, because you cannot integrate unless you intend to help.
Can you
can call it a byproduct of the intent to help. Because if you haven't got the intent to help, you will never integrate. Remember, it's the will that does it. And if you don't intend to help others towards it, you haven't got a unified will. Because we've said that one man is all men. On our diagram here, we've shown by that rotation that every man is receiving from all men, and therefore he doesn't even know what's his own. The idea that is in his mind isn't his idea, everybody's got it. The stress varies in individuals, but not the content. And therefore, only if you want to make the whole universe whole can you integrate. Because if you tried to integrate with any other purpose of making the whole, you'd be illogical.
Now, by overcoming these various aspects of the law of nature, will we actually see this to be the method of acting, actually? If we overcome all the lower urges and bring them under control, will we actually see that we've got to do this?
Oh, yes. Now, you know that exercise we did once? When I gave you something and asked you to do something, and you threw it down. Now, that kind of feeling that arose in you then was tremendously important. Because there is always something that if you were very, very refined in your feeling, you would do. Because it would be the very thing to do at that moment. It may not be a thing that everybody else would like, because it may introduce a temporary disequilibrium, a temporary ill health in them. But it would be in the right direction. And after a time, you would be forgiven for having done it. Although it upset people at the moment. That feeling is only awareness of your will intent when it is identified with the universal will. But you've introduced it yourself, it's come out of you, and therefore you're ready to consider this fact. That if you don't will the wholeness of the whole, you cannot integrate. No amount of effort, no amount of cleverness of fitting ideas together will fit them if you are merely trying to integrate yourself as a finite individual.
How's that going?
I'm not clear.
Oh, good. Is it nice?
Well.
I have something along the fact that if we have, let's say, stimulating drugs and something like that, we feel like doing lots of good and I've experienced that personally. And I was thinking of something along the lines of. We get a certain amount of integration and we feel we've got loads of energy to spare and we want to do good. You see? Now, is it something else without style?
Nothing to do with it.
Nothing to do with it at all.
If you've got a feeling you want to do good, it's automatically wrong in that sense. That kind of feeling, isn't it? There's no urgency about it. It's quite different from the kind of feeling that most people get when they say, I want to do so-and-so. I would like to help you, and so on. Those things are inclinations. And when you're learning integration, you're not concerned with inclinations of that order. When you get to another order, a new kind of emotion appears. A new kind of feeling. It's not gushy, it's not zeal. But it does more, and more persistently, and more often. And always with conscious control of the situation.
Is what I put to you a private purpose? What I explained?
Yes, yes.
Selfish?
Yes. By definition it is. It didn't include the whole of the whole, did it? It was a false stress, you see. And those false stresses are the things that attract the thing that you think you want and then invert it into its opposite. You've got to be terribly careful about what you say is valuable because you might get it.
Is that parasite again?
Mm-hmm. You know that the moment you introduce an idea as valuable into yourself, you have already introduced fear that you may not get it. And that fear is a disintegrating force. If you had absolute faith in this wholeness of the universe and yourself as a sort of spinning force within it, and that force is intelligent, you would know that your evolution is already perfect. All you have to do is realize your perfection of being. In the time process, you're continuously presented with a statement that you're imperfect by imperfect beings. Beings in a state of suffering or pain who assure you that the universe is no good, and they tend to taint your imagination and make you falsely value things. When it says in the book, he who has faith does not hurry up, that's what it means. The universe is already whole. We are inside it. Nothing can get out of it and nothing can get into it without its will. Everything that happens inside it is happening by the spontaneous development of universal will, and your private will within it is only private because you privated it. So deficiency is really willed. The other day a fellow was talking to me, and he was talking about kindness and how he never gets any from his dear wife. And he was in such a state of misery, I said to him, well, you know, she doesn't have a life of continuous joy, does she? And he bounced and he said, do you really think not? And I said, of course not. But you know what, I feel better now. You see? And that was that terrible justice idea. Surely there's a God in the world. Surely you twist her arm for her. See? This kind of little individual bias is pursuing something. He thinks he wants heaven. He thinks that there can be a new heaven and a new earth, and that they might get the new heaven on this new earth now, if only white people behave and stop throwing the chips on the wallpaper.
Is
this a
universal role, this idea to think it's nice to have things nice?
It's not nice to have things nice if we don't deserve it. We should deserve it, shouldn't we? We should be fit for it. We should be in such a state when we get it that we won't throw it away.
Isn't our tendency, though, always to consider that we are fit for it as individuals? It's other people that are lacking.
Never found that. Not in a man that examines himself. I've heard people say it, but never believe it. I've never seen a man that sits back and says, really, well, I'm ready for perfection. It's just those other can't. Not really. You may say so, but that's just diversion.
You see all sorts of people today, though, that are starting to improve their homes.
Mow the lawn flatter and flatter.
But it's a direction of the will towards an improvement, isn't it?
Yes.
An improvement of what? The lawn?
To your circumstances?
We've said that if you don't go against your inclination, you cannot integrate yourself. Those people that make the lawn flat, if you said to them, do you know your lawn is sticking up in the middle, they get excited. Unless it isn't, you know, but it must be because it's part of the earth, you know, and that's round. So if you make it really flat, it'll be relatively concave and the rain will collect in the centre. Won't it? They won't like that idea. They want it flat. I tell that to a fellow who is very fond of playing billiards once. And if his billiard table were really flat, all the balls would roll to the centre. And he ran round the room and shouted and said it was stupid. So I did him a big drawing of the world with a big billiard table going straight and showed him that it was farther away from the earth on the ends than it was in the middle. And therefore, relatively, it was an inclined plane and balls put on it must roll towards the centre. And he was very upset. And he said, you're not going to put me off my game. Because he thought he'd have to make allowances for it. This is the real meaning of private purpose, isn't it? To see things in a very peculiar way, just as you want them, and not to want to know anything else. One of the early Greeks, thinking about the sun, made the statement, the sun is bigger than Greece. Whereupon they said, if you say that again, we'll kill you. You see? They liked it that way. Remember what happened when they altered the calendar? After you got 11 days out in England, and they had to make up for the 11 days, the mob came with stones and they shattered every window in every official building in London, shouting, we want our 11 days back. Just because they'd altered the calendar. They thought they'd somehow managed to nip out 11 days. It was a genuine belief, because they thought they were being robbed. And they knew that governments rob you of everything possible, and therefore they knew that they'd take 11 days away. You have to be very careful what you define as your good. Because remember, your gullet is more fond of carpet slippers in general than it is of hard work. But it can't evolve and get what it wants without refuting itself as prime inclination. Schopenhauer we're talking about today. Schopenhauer is a German pessimist. He was a pessimist because he learned from Indian sources, from the Upanishads, that the world is will manifesting as idea, and the will wants to do something which it can't do because it doesn't know how. So then it decides to learn how. And when it learns how, what it learns is that it can't do it because when you learn how, you become reasonable. And the reason refutes the irrational will. So he sat down and cried bitterly about that and got a very funny face, which is a marvellous thing to look at. If you get a good portrait of Schopenhauer, you will see what it means to believe that the will, when it becomes reasonable, is dissatisfied. And it's significant that he became a woman hater in the process. Be careful how you define what you're after, because you may get it. And whatever you get, something goes with it.
Good night.
Just because it's good.
Yeah. It's going to make me feel better. It's going to make me better all the way around. But I'm not going to do it for that reason.
No, that's right. If you do it for that reason, you'll go wrong. The Bhagavad Gita is about nothing else except action without regard to the fruits.
The point is this: you feel horrible, so you do it, so you won't feel horrible anymore. You're not going to be that way.
No. Do it because it's better. Do the right because the right is better than the wrong. Have a good will because a good will is better than a bad one. Quite independently of the fruits to you in the process. The fruits come, but don't look at them, you'll get into trouble.
May I say this? I stopped smoking, you see, 4 months ago.
Mm.
The simple purpose, I want to integrate.
Mm.
Now, I stopped smoking at once before, about it, I stopped about a year. Now, the first time, it was a test of willpower, you see. Mm-hmm. Now, after I actually got rid of the habit, I turned around and said, ah, well, it's better not to smoke. And I thought, what will happen in this particular case? We overcome things egotistically, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after overcoming them, or to a certain extent overcoming them, we turn around and say, oh, it's better not to behave the other way.
That's right.
Is that what it is?
Yes. Actually, come in the end to will good because it's good.
And we mustn't pay any attention to the fruits.
If you do, you'll fall.
Afterwards, I mean, after the event, after you've done the thing, you're not allowed to enjoy the good feeling it might bring.
Suppose you spontaneously do a very good deed for a little old lady crossing the road. And she has a basket and you carry it across, and she says, because you've carried it, you can have that lovely Jaffa orange which is in it. You see, and she presses it on you and you go home. So you eat it. But if it conditions your behaviour in any way whatever so that you look for little old ladies with baskets, you're in trouble. And as soon as you start looking for fruits, you've gone off your will, which is the only thing that you are concerned with. The orange tastes exactly the same, you see, whether you bought it, or had it given to you, or earned it, or stole it.
Yes, but if you don't do it because you think you might get an orange, when you've done it, you feel a bit better about things, you're quite pleased because you did do it. You're not entitled to enjoy that feeling.
Enjoy? What do you mean? You're entitled to recognise that it's there.
That's what I want to know.
That feeling only shows that a bit of energy that was locked up has been released and has been made available for you. You know, there are some people who get terribly trapped because they become good deed doers because of that feeling.
They drink a bit.
And they become horrible prigs later.
I don't mean to do the things only because of a good feeling.
You shouldn't do it because of a good feeling at all. Leave that till you get to heaven. Just do it. Do it. And when the good feeling comes, just recognise that was a good feeling. But of course it should be. It was a good act. But that's not why I did it. Look at the inherent logic of it.
Well, I shouldn't be miserable about having a good feeling.
It's very hard to be miserable about a good feeling. Try it. It's an exercise, isn't it? Try and make yourself miserable when you just won that thingy boy. It's a real tendency when you do a good deed to feel better, and then the next thing you just think, oh, I'll do it because I felt better. But when you do that, you've altered the relation, the field relation between yourself and the person you do the good deed to. And if you're not careful, that person will say, I know why you're doing this, you felt good last time, didn't you?
See? I might die and leave you something.
Yes. No, you see, it's that hairline stretching between here and there, and you've got to keep on it. It's the narrow way. It's not Aristotelian's golden mean, you see. The Aristotelian view of the mean is very mean. It's petty, steering between difficulties with great care. What Christ was talking about was something entirely different. Keep your will on it, sufficient for the day's evil thereof. Do what you can. If something nice comes, don't divert yourself and say, where did that come from? Is there any more good deeds I can do over there? A good scout on Bobber Job Week does his job, he looks at the bob, and he doesn't think specifically that he should have done the job for the bob. If he's a proper scout, he can give the bob away, won't he? To the cause.
Not a scout suit has had to, and I've just wondered where they got that scout uniform.
No, but as Gurdjieff said in the beginning, it first must be an egotistical act. It must be
not. It must be, unless you understand what the word must means.
Well, let's say it usually.
What's
so
word
in this case, anyhow?
What does the word must mean?
Well, it implies no other way.
Does it?
Must.
Does it imply there's no other way? It's actually means your primary appetite is self-crucified. If you must do it, you're talking about the direction of your own will. Actually, it's a technical term for what elephants feel when they're sexually excited. They're said to be on must. You see? The most. Goethe says, when you know Goethe when he was very old, he hadn't quite, he was a bit like Moses, he was still in the fullness of his powers. When he was 74, he fell in love with a girl of 17 and then cried because nobody would let him marry her. And said, what has age got to do with it? I've got a young heart. And then he said, ich liebe, weil ich lieben muss. I love because I must. But do you know, he was a very, very good philologist, and he knew that the German müssen meant primary will squirting itself out. Now, must you? That depends whether you've got the power to turn it back. And that's must not, with a K in it. A lot of people think that they must do things, and you suddenly give them a bit more information, and then they must not. Must only means that will driving and crucifying itself.
Well, right now I'm using a name. I'm using the name Haraway. So you just speed things up, so I call the house Haraway.
Well,
the point is this. When I start to think about it too much, I want to take it down again because I start to think, well, I know, it might mean that I'm going to die tomorrow because in 1,000 years' time it will speak me up somewhat, you see. I don't know that.
You don't know?
No. It makes me think about whether I should use it.
Well, you see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, thinking about names, changed his own name recently, and then his wife changed her name to Hera, who is the wife of Zeus. And she'd become absolutely the authority about the place. And then she said to me, my husband is thinking of changing his name to Zeus. So I said, well, do you know what Zeus did? She said, no, what did he do? Well, that shows the level. She takes on a name without examining the meaning of any of it. I said, well, Zeus spent all his time dodging his wife Hera and nipping to earth and seducing all the adorable maidens there. Oh, she said, that's the game, is it? She said, he's not going to be called Zeus. I said, that's exactly what Hera did in the whole of the mythology, spent her time interfering with him. Zeus means the glistening ether. Hera is the power ripple that goes through it. She's the power ripple that goes through his glistening ether. He's sitting there glistening as he keeps going through it. Ken knows him. But he does glisten, doesn't he? You feel it, eh? You see, it's an invocation, isn't it? The Hera way, that means saying you have chosen the way of the hierarchical powers. That means you believe there's something below you and something above you, and that you'd rather be up than down, and that you're asking that power to come and lift you up.
We did very quickly. I just got thrown out of the place I was at.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing thing. You know, the biggest power centre of atomic research, well, the first project, it was Haribo, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For the same reason. It's a Hera function. And in the mythology of the Indians, the naughty god Hari, the same fellow, is the fellow who goes about looking for ambitious people and persuading them to become followers of Hari. And he's always got a dirty job for them to do when they've got up. He makes them up and up and up and up, and they think, yes, it's quite right, I'm doing God good service by elevating myself. Suddenly they say, now you're a governor, you see, and we want these 50,000 blokes there burning and making into soap. It doesn't matter, they'll only write a rude word about you in the history books, and you won't be here at the time. When Hitler, whose name was Schicklgruber, you see, changed his name from Schicklgruber to Hitler, he chose a name meaning to break truces and use violence. That's the definition of the Hittites. The Hittite law was what he chose.
His real name was Schicklgruber, sent from the grave. He's a dead man, come from below. And his Austria is outside the law of Germany, and the Germans hate the Austrians, therefore they're biased to listen to one if he's got the nerve to speak. And you tried, keep it a bit. You're not the first person I know that chose it and tried it a bit.
Oh, I intend to watch.
Keep it as long as you can.
Oh, I tell you what happened. I was threatened to be thrown out. And back on to going out, they rather turned back and wish they hadn't done. I landed in a very good place.
For the moment.
Now, everything's gone suspiciously quiet this last few weeks.
This can be a good thing for you, because the universe has got a hierarchy in it, and providing you keep your will right, and you will only the wholeness of the whole, and not simply you, it won't do you any harm, and it will accelerate you.
It's gone suspicious of quietness last time.
Well, as long as you're suspicious of the quietness, you'll be all right. Have you got the name, really? Did you remember the name? And he was so convinced that everybody attending his school was a half-wit. His eyes were shining with merriment. And he had a wonderful broad smile, which was supposed to be bliss. And he was just standing in the middle of them, and it was absolutely pathetic to see them. There was a girl there with her arms out like this. The interviewer said, "You're being a triad, Mr. Henry, is that right?" She said, "Yes." And she was going like this, and she said, "Well, you're wobbling a bit from tree, you know." And she said, "Well, I'm not used to talking and being a tree at the same time." And he said, "What did you get out of it?" She said, "Oh, well, when we've done this a long time, we can concentrate." He said, "Can you concentrate?" And she said, "No." "Well, I think I'm beginning to do it." And he said, "What do you do next?" She said, "Meditate, and that's very difficult." And he said, "You can't meditate then." "Oh no," she said, "that's a long way off." Then he said to a man that was there, "I understand that some of you fellows have yogic powers. Have you got some yogic powers?" And this man said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, can you give me an example of one of your yogic powers?" And he says, "Yes." He said, "Mind you," he said, "we're not supposed to use these yogic powers for selfish material purposes." The interviewer said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, he said, I can take colder baths than most people. So if the weather's a bit cold and I want to go for a swim, well then I can do it." And the interviewer said, "That's the yogic power. What are the others?" He said, "Oh well, they're like that, you know." And then in a corner there were some others harmonising themselves, shouting "Om" all together. Well, it was a wonderful bunch of half-wits. There was an Indian there who's taken this on, with the reputation of India behind him, and a lot of monks there who pay him so much a year to do this, and he'd got them so well conditioned that they wouldn't tell the interviewer how much they're paid. They counted by saying, if somebody cannot afford, they will receive it free. But what it was, they wouldn't say. They were just stupid because they were looking for fruits. And he's got them completely conditioned to do quite silly things, and to believe that he's the cat's whiskers in there, simply because he's an Indian and yoga is supposed to come out of India. And they didn't even get their terms right. They were referring to yogi as yoga and yoga as yogi, and behaving in a very, very stupid manner. And if people are looking for fruits, then that's the kind of thing that they'll get into if they're not careful. If you wind it up.
Really, the thing I've got to do then, any improvements I've actually made on myself that have been beneficial in a way whatsoever, for instance, stopping drinking or perhaps stopping smoking, if I can actually lead somebody else, not only by example, but by other methods I'm to present themselves by and to mention it to them, or lead them to a better situation where they old habits won't crop up. I'll definitely be doing a good thing.
You have to be very careful about that, Tim, because if you particularise it, you can make a mistake. Because it's a whole. It's got to be made whole. It's already been disrupted by the parts. There's such a thing as introducing a new disruption. It's like this interpretation and this use of the word parasite. When I used the word, and they are asked to think about it, they came to the conclusion, some of them, that I was suggesting they were parasitic on me. And that was a measure only of the idea that received the energy that was contained in the word.
In actual fact, they were quite right by that definition of parasite, but...
But not in the way they thought.
Not the way they thought, no.
Not in the way they thought.
Yeah.
So if you try a particular thing, like leading a particular person to, say, give up being an alcoholic or something...
Not a particular idea against a particular person, then.
You see, that person might be going the other way. If you're concerned with the whole, one person might be going that way rather than another way. They must go that way by the definition we gave before, they're willing it. That's what must happen. And to deprive them of that opportunity might be doing them a disservice, might be prolonging their evolution instead of shortening it. You know that feeling that you had when you threw that thing on the floor? That's what you want. You get that feeling with people, you see, if somebody's there and he's a drunken sot. You might feel the situation like you did then, and you might say something or nothing. And if you do with that feeling, what you say or do will be right. I once gave a drunk a bottle of whiskey while he was drunk. Tell him to go the whole hog. I said, you're not doing it right. Nowhere near bad enough. I said, you think you're being wicked. He thought he was being wicked. He got fed up. He'd had a row with his girlfriend. And he was going to show her he was no good by getting drunk. But he wanted to be only drunk enough so he could walk there and tell her he was no good. So I said, no, you must really do it. I said, no, when you've done it, I'll tell her that you're no good. And I should really believe it. Can I come and show you? They made him face the situation. He was only kidding. He didn't really want to be no good. That feeling is very peculiar because it penetrates right into the meaning of the situation. Because it is out of the continuum.
I have to have a colour chart.
It becomes not a good thing for us, it's a bad thing. But we can't get any reason behind it.
Well, you know, it says in the book that that can't happen, doesn't it? No man is tempted beyond his strength. It's a statement about level. See, a man cannot be tempted unless he can see.
Yes, that's what comes up to me.
He must be able to see a situation, otherwise it's no temptation for him. In every temptation you have an alternative. The purpose of temporal presentation at all is to isolate problems so that you face them one at a time.